Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox will speak with a doctor about heart disease rates. He'll chat with the head of Scouting America, which is celebrating an anniversary, and Jay will interview an expert on the importance of planning your paid time off. Plus, Angela Ann is in for Doug Petcash of Face the State, and we'll have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
Heart disease is an issue that plagues not only our Central Ohio community, but all of us here in the Buckeye State. It is estimated that as many as 6% of Ohioans have coronary heart disease, and the rate of death exceeds the national average. Pickaway County, south of Columbus, is of specific concern. Dr. Clyde Yancey is the chief of cardiology at Northwestern Medicine Blum Cardiovascular Institute and joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Welcome, doctor.
Jay, thanks so much. I'm delighted to have this conversation with you, and I'm so pleased that you started with the context of what's happening there in Ohio. Let's talk about heart disease.
Well, let's start with the basics, because not everybody knows what that term means. What exactly is heart disease?
Let's not make it that difficult. Let's think about any time the heart and blood vessels are no longer functioning in a normal way, you are at least at risk for heart disease. I know that sounds like a broad definition. What does that risk mean? It means heart attacks, which we all fear, strokes, irregular heart rhythms, weakened heart muscles, even some kidney conditions. We need to appreciate that any time the heart and blood vessels are no longer functioning normal, we are at risk. So preserving the function of our heart and blood vessels should be a high priority.
Who is most at risk, and why do these groups experience higher rates of heart disease?
Well, Jay, just like in Ohio and here in Illinois, everybody's at risk. Even across the country, everybody's at risk. No group is protected or has a lower incidence. Some groups have even a higher likelihood, but ultimately, it all comes down to the decisions we make, our lifestyle, and how we manage our health conditions going forward.
So what are the risk factors for heart disease? And don't tell me I have to put my bacon cheeseburger down.
So, you know, let's go through the traditional risk factors, but let's talk about things in a different way. Traditionally, we tell you, don't smoke, follow a heart health diet, exercise. All of those are things that you've heard before. That's not information. But here's the new information. If we can change the frame and think about just being more active instead of exercise per se. If we think about diet and think about it in terms of just eating a bit less, giving us the latitude to enjoy your favorite beverage, your favorite snack, but doing it in moderation. If we think about it in terms of having information, knowing your blood pressure, knowing your weight, knowing your cholesterol, even knowing your hemoglobin A1C, once we put it in those positive terms, yes, there are risk factors, but all of these risk factors are modifiable, meaning we can do something about this risk.
We have seen over the course of the last 18 months the rise of treatment for diabetes as a weight loss drug. Can heart disease be cured?
When we think about cure, we have to pause for a moment and understand that the greater question is, can we manage the condition and can we restore health? We know that weight loss, no matter how you get there, is one of the most important ways we can restore health. We know that some of the new therapies have a profound influence on either the risk for heart disease or in certain situations already established heart disease. But the most important consideration is that we can manage this condition, that is heart conditions, we can restore health, that is heart health, and we can follow practices that don't involve medical therapies at all, but involve lifestyle decisions and help us do better and feel better.
When we talk about those lifestyle decisions, we've heard over the last 30 years that we have to be conscious of our cholesterol, conscious of our fat intake, you know, definitely eat our greens. Where does medicine stand right now and how we should be behaving in order to prevent heart disease?
So, Jay, for you and everyone listening, let's not think about the last 30 years. Let's think about the last 24 hours. What did you do in the last 24 hours that promoted your health? Did you get enough sleep last night? Did you go for an additional walk? Were you physically active? What did you have for dinner last night, breakfast this morning? My point is this. We understand with great clarity what's necessary to reduce the burden of heart disease. all we have to do is incorporate it in our lives and make these decisions real time. Today, not tomorrow, next week, not a New Year's resolution, but a new life resolution.
So if we want to learn more about the subjects that we've discussed today, is there a website that we can direct our listeners?
Absolutely. If you go to our website, nm.org/heart, or go to the American Heart Association website, I'm a major volunteer for that organization, you can find trusted information that will give you great guidance on the steps that all of us can take to reduce the risk of heart disease and have longer, happier, healthier lives.
Dr. Clyde Yancey is the Chief of Cardiology at Northwestern. We thank you so much for being with us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
The Simon Kenton Council is one of the largest councils in the country, serving 18 Ohio Scouting Councils, including right here in Central Ohio. It is estimated that nearly 9,000 Ohio youth members participate. In 2024, the Boy Scouts changed their name to Scouting America as part of an inclusivity move and now allow female members. They're celebrating their 115th birthday this year. What a birthday indeed. Roger Krohn is their president and CEO. He's from Cincinnati, Ohio, and he joins us on Columbus Perspective. Welcome and happy birthday.
Hey, good morning, Jay. Great to be here.
So what plans does Scouting America have for the big celebration?
Well, we've actually taken 2 weeks. We're doing events like this. By the way, we're lighting up monuments across the country, including the Cleveland Terminal Tower and the Empire State Building. We have some New York events planned over the weekend. And because we're going through a rebrand, there's a lot of signage that needs to be adjusted. So we've got some groundbreaking scheduled for next week on new signage.
Now, it's been a rough few years. How is Scouting America recovering from bankruptcy?
Well, we've been out of bankruptcy for 18 months. Membership is up. Our donor base is up. Our brand is up. You know, the kids, you know, we suffered from COVID and bankruptcy, and so we're recovering from that. We're welcoming all youth in America to our program, and they're coming back to do those traditional things that we do in scouting, like camping, hiking, and fishing. But maybe more exciting is they're also coming back to do our new programs, like digital technology and artificial intelligence and drones and gaming.
That sounds exciting. The program unfortunately faced scrutiny for sexual assaults and had to pay out almost $2 billion in settlements. Where do things stand now, and how are you keeping scouts safe?
Right, so we fully funded a settlement trust for the survivor victims of that happened in our past. And so our number one priority going forward is to keep the youth in our programs safe. So we run the safest youth-serving program that we possibly can. And there are two aspects of that, the traditional, you know, aquatics, camping-type safety, first aid, and then your topic is safeguarding, what we call safeguarding youth. So we have a two-deep rule with adults, so an adult is never alone with a youth in our program. We do screening, we do training, right? We train our adult volunteers, we train our unit leaders, and we train our kids. And then we've gone digital. As the threat has gone to the internet and has gone digital, and of course, all of our kids have a small screen digital device, we want to educate our kids on what a friendly text is and what an unfriendly text is. So that's been added to our training. We've actually gone to an anonymous text reporting. So it's just sort of a technology challenge. But now, you know, every kid who has a digital device can use that digital device as part of our safeguarding program.
Diversity, equity, and inclusion have been at the forefront of changes in the federal administration. Will the Scouts reverse their inclusivity policy as a result of new federal trends?
We are here, right, to transform the lives of youth in America. That is our purpose. by our bylaws, we are apolitical. So we made changes in our membership standards to welcome girls into our program, our Cub program at 18, and girls into our Scouts PSA program, because we wanted to serve the greatest number of youth. That is our core, our foundation, and that's what we'll continue to do.
What does the future look like for Scouting America?
Well, we're going to continue to grow. We're going to serve more youth. We're going to transform more lives, and we're going to prepare the kids in America for life. The aims of our program are to develop character, leadership, citizenship, and personal fitness. We've been doing that for over a century, and we're going to continue to do that for another century.
For folks that want to know how to look up Scouting America, is there a website?
Yes, we are scouting.org. If you want to just learn more generally about our programs, if you'd like to join, beascout.org. And then, like everyone, we have terrific kids, and they take pictures and videos all the time of the terrific experiences that they're having. So if you go into your social media browser and just type in Scouting, you will get hundreds of videos where you can experience firsthand the fun that kids have in our program.
We want to thank Roger Krohn, the president and CEO of Scouting America, for joining us today, and a big 115th birthday celebration coming on for Scouting America and for Columbus Perspective. I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
We're only a month or so into the new year, but employees here in Central Ohio are already looking at the calendar, thinking about where they're going to go on vacation, spring break, summer vacations, fall journeys. But get this, gang. Recent data reveals something interesting. 50% of vacation time goes, wait for it, unused each year. Workers are juggling their workloads. They're trying to carve out time for themselves. The challenge of getting that all-important PTO scheduled is a struggle. Roxy Kaus, the millennial manager, is here to share tips and advice on securing and making the most of your time off. Welcome, Roxy. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. Roxy, what's standing in the way of taking our vacation days in 2025? Because I know for me, it's an issue.
Yeah, same for me. So there are a number of factors that are standing in the way of us taking our vacation time in 2025. Workload pressure, company culture, small team sizes, saving that time for an emergency. As you alluded to, recent data shows that people are leaving a lot of time on the table, which equates to billions in lost time that could be used to recharge, connect with loved ones. And we live in a work-first culture, so we feel bad about taking our time off.
Yeah, it's true. There is some sort of inherent guilt about, I wonder what's going to happen if I'm not there. So, Roxy, what is this time-off toolbox that you guys are touting?
Yeah, so the time off toolbox. So Choice Hotels, the company that has Radisson, Cambria, Comfort, and several other brands, is making it easy for us to take our time off and changing the way that we think about time off. And Choice Hotel partnered with writer actor Keegan Michael Key to launch Choice Hotels timeofftoolbox.com, where the tool is spelled with three O's for out of office, and basically it is helpful tips, tricks, tools to help you maximize your time off, to ask for time off. There's auto responses that you can, leverage for time off, out of office replies. There, you can even create a custom video featuring Keegan that you can send to your boss, and just so many other resources available.
So tell me, if I want Keegan to petition for some time off, how does that work?
Yeah, so if you visit Choice Hotels timeofftoolbox.com, you go through a couple of prompts, and then it spits out this video, and that you can then send, you can download, you can send it, and it's really funny. I highly recommend checking it out.
Is it free?
Yes, it is.
I'm definitely going to do it.
Oh, you absolutely should.
I'm not a millennial. but I understand that millennials have even more of a challenge with this issue than everyone else. Why?
Yeah, so for millennials, one, I've worked in corporate for well over a decade, so I also experience these same challenges of the mentally, like thinking about, like, when do we take our time off? Should we take our time off? Worried about all the other factors involved in taking time off. We even overthink, what am I going to say to my boss? What's my out of my vacation response going to be? And so, what Choice Hotel is doing is with the time off toolbox is making requesting time off effortless, so that you can focus on maximizing your time off. And some of the ways to maximize time off is think about taking it around those popular holidays, so like Memorial Day or July 4th, where if those days fall on a Monday or a Friday and you even take just one day off, now you have like a four-day week, so just a longer vacation. And another way to maximize your time off is to use rewards. So, for example, the choice privileges and book directly on the hotel website. So now you're staying at Choice Hotel and you're redeeming points for additional nights or other perks. So there's a number of different things that we can do to maximize that time off, and definitely helpful for millennials who struggle with getting started.
Back in the day, Ohioans used to say, all right, we're going to go to Florida, we're going to go over the Christmas holiday, and we're going to go for spring break. But there's some new trends in travel. What is some of that data showing us?
Yeah, so there new data is showing that people are wanting to spend more on experiences than things. And so you might not be aware, but I live in Dayton. So I am right down the street from Columbus, and
we could have done this with a tin can and string then.
Oh, absolutely. Exactly.
Got it.
So we often take, a lot of times when we think about our time off, it's like, oh, I need to go somewhere. I need to take this long, extravagant vacation. No, you can literally, in your backyard, there's things to do. And so, for example, we'll do like trips to Columbus, and there's so many, like the nightlife, the outdoor spaces, the museum, the zoo, the Scioto Mile. There's just so many things that you can take advantage of in your backyard.
Backyard, I will tell you that this past year, the best trip I took was to Yellow Springs.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. All right. So, Roxy, where can we get more information?
Yeah, so for more information, head over to Choice Hotels, timeofftoolbox.com. And like I mentioned early on, tool is spelled with three O's, O-O-O for out of office, just to find more information about the Time Off Toolbox.
All right, we want to thank Roxy Kaus for being our guest. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Angela Ann from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
Unprecedented action from the Oval Office is causing reaction from Americans. In Ohio and across the U.S., thousands of people are taking to the streets and their state capitals, protesting a wide range of policies rolling out from the Trump administration. And policies, they argue, are an overreach from the president. But are they? Thanks for joining us for Face the State. I'm Angela Ann, sitting in for Doug Petkash today. Well, let's take a look at some of the actions the president has taken so far that are raising some legal concerns. Right now, the president is preparing to gut the U.S. Education Department, proposing a U.S. takeover of the Gaza Strip, and ordering the FBI to turn over a complete list of agents who investigated the January 6th riots and his classified documents case. The Trump administration is also offering every CIA worker a buyout to resign. Now, President Trump is also backing Elon Musk's actions in leading the new Department of Government Efficiency. And already, Musk has gained access to the U.S. Treasury and Environmental Protection Agency. Musk and Trump also began shutting down the U.S. Agency for International Development, also known as USAID. And the legal battle over Trump's attempts to end automatic birthright citizenship is now in the courts. That brings us today to our expert on constitutional law, Ruth Kolker has published more than 50 articles in law journals, and she's had her work cited twice by the United States Supreme Court. So Ohio State University Professor Ruth Kolker, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was a lot to get through, but let's first start with this. The claims that President Trump is overstepping his executive power, what are the concerns to you? And do you think that there is actually a case here to be made?
Oh, there's definitely a case to be made that he's stepping over his authority, and I would say it's probably deliberate on his part. I mean, just to take the birthright citizenship example, mm-hmm. we've already had several courts conclude that that executive order was unconstitutional. Those judges range the spectrum from having been appointed by Republican presidents or Democratic presidents. Their opinions have been extremely strong because there's just no plausible argument that he can ban birthright citizenship. And so, yeah, why did he do it? I assume he did it for political reasons, mm-hmm. and knowing that the courts would strike it down. In his first term as president, he had many of his actions struck down by the courts. And I think we'll see the same thing this time around. We already have. There's something like 7 courts have already struck down conduct of his administration.
Already. The first couple of weeks, yeah.
Yeah, that's unprecedented.
Well, as we said, Trump is already in a legal battle, like you said, over the birthright citizenship. So where does that one specifically stand now? Because there's so many people out there feeling like they're in limbo and not knowing the legalities of this.
Well, so there is a national injunction in place that will not permit that executive order to go into effect. I think it was the end of February or so that it's supposed to go into effect. And the reason the courts have been so quick to strike down that executive order is the Constitution says specifically that all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the state wherein they reside. So if you're a conservative member of the court who really believes that we should emphasize the textual meaning of the document, there's text. And so that's why we're seeing both judges who swing more liberal or swing more conservative just saying, read the text. Mm-hmm. You can't do this. You could try to amend the Constitution, but that's, of course, a very difficult step, and that's not going to happen.
And lengthy, too. So for people out there who are feeling a little uneasy, perhaps just wait it out, let this all play out. And
yeah, well, at this point, it's not in effect. I would be shocked.
Yeah.
I really would be shocked if it ever went into effect.
All right, let's talk about the buyout. You know, when you hear about a buyout in a typical world, you're thinking, okay, great, I'm going to get some money. I'm going to, you know, go retire, do something fun. But the buyout for federal workers, a judge has also temporarily blocked that, pushing that deadline a little bit for these workers to accept it or not. Does the Constitution, Ruth, actually grant the president the ability to do these mass buyouts?
Well, that mass buyout actually didn't occur through an executive order. That came from a directive from the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, agency. And they did that by sending out an email to nearly all federal workers telling them that they could take this buyout. So there has been a lawsuit filed. We have so many lawsuits, it's hard to keep track of them. And you mentioned that a judge has temporarily said you can't do this minute. He hasn't said you can't do it ever. I mean, it's just on hold.
Right.
And the lawsuit that's been brought has been brought by unions that represent federal workers. And one of the very basic arguments that they're making is that this email from OPM doesn't comply with the contracts that unions have, unionized workers have with the federal government. That's just one of many arguments that are made. This is something that's being decided under what's called the Administrative Procedures Act, and I don't even teach that statute, although it's hard not to know something about it. So that's a different problem. I think it's actually more complicated mm-hmm. than like birthright citizenship. The other thing President Trump has done through an executive order, which hasn't gotten as much press, is he moved a lot of federal workers to what he calls Schedule F. That's a new schedule that they invented during his first administration. It never went into effect because Biden eliminated it when he was elected. But it's a new category for people he considers politically affiliated, which is different than politically appointed. And he's trying to move a lot of civil service workers to Schedule F. That also will likely be challenged in court because it's not clear that the president has the authority to just create these new rules about civil service employees who have statutory protections that Congress has created.
He's trying to create new categories, in other words, what you're saying, to perhaps fit whatever agenda that he wants, but it's not fitting with the legal statute.
That's right, because Congress is the one that creates the civil service.
Yeah.
And so the president is not allowed to act contrary to a congressional statute. Mm. And it appears that the Schedule F decision on his part is something that could happen if Congress wanted to, but Congress hasn't taken those steps.
Let's talk about DOGE, because that certainly is making a lot of headlines right now. And a lot of people are even saying, you know, the Constitution grants Congress the power to establish new federal government offices and departments, but this was created without Congress. So is it even legit?
Well, the president is allowed to hire people to be advisors to him. You know, he has a chief of staff, and the chief of staff doesn't have to be approved by Congress. So there are things the president can do to have advisors around him. But DOGE goes well beyond that because, as you know, the employees of DOGE are now going to Treasury, going to Labor, as you said, I think, in your opening, and looking at documents. And so that's a significant problem because there's no statute that directs or contemplates that conduct. What they've done is they've made those people temporary employees of those departments so that they can have some legal cover for them doing some of this work. But there's also been a lawsuit filed against that step. And again, it's been the labor unions that have filed that lawsuit, saying that the way DOGE has been accessing information violates various privacy laws that have been enacted in recent years. The most recent is a 2014 statute called the Federal Information Security Modernization Act that has to do with the important need for security for all the stuff on the internet, on the web. We're all very worried about that these days, right? And so it appears that they're not following the security protocols that Congress requires. So again, butting up against what Congress has said, sure, President can't override Congress.
All right, we have about a minute left. I want to end with this one question because this really affects our foreign relations with partners around the world. The president wanting to gut USAID. I know that it was mandated in 1961 to establish this agency with foreign assistance. So can he just say, nope, sorry, we're out, we're done?
So there was a second statute passed in 1998 that requires that agency to exist. And so you'll notice they're keeping, 170 employees. And so is that the same as having gotten rid of the agency? And, again, that will be challenged in court. We'll have to see. But there's, again, a statute, and the president isn't allowed to disregard federal statutes.
And a process, too.
In a process, and that's part of the problem, and the same with the civil service. That's part of the problem, that there's a process.
Well, I think we're going to keep you on retainer, Ruth, because certainly there is a lot to get through with just what we've seen so far in the first weeks of the new administration and what's to come, which is anyone's game at this point.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot for having me. I'm happy to come back anytime you need me.
We appreciate your time. Thank you so much. You just heard Ruth talk about Elon Musk and DOGE. And right now, the world's richest man is saying that he will use his department to shut down what he's calling, quote, illegal payments to several nonprofits connected to the Lutheran faith. That includes Lutheran Social Services of Central Ohio. They oversee more than half a dozen programs for countless communities. 10TV's Carla Vogner took this concern to the nonprofit's CEO.
Lutheran Social Services has not received any communication that they'll actually lose funding, just the threat in Musk's post.
So I've been coming to the health center for about 4 or 5 months now.
When Tashana Davis unexpectedly became homeless last year, she sought shelter at Lutheran Social Services.
So when I first got here, I couldn't see, so I take vision.
They were able to fix her vision at the Low Barrier Health Center.
I can see now.
And help her get a job at Lowe's. Now she's moving out soon into an apartment.
I am grateful that LSS was here.
It's patients like her that CEO Rachel Lustig worries about if LSS would lose federal funding.
It's personal because it's about people that we know getting the care and support that they need.
On Sunday, President Trump's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, shared a post on X accusing several Lutheran organizations of money laundering, including Lutheran Social Services of Central Ohio. Elon Musk shared the post saying the DOGE team is rapidly shutting down these illegal payments.
Lutheran Social Services receives 70% of our grant funding from the federal government. That represents almost $16 million in our community. Those dollars help us to provide our food assistance programs. They help us to provide our domestic violence programs, our homeless shelter, and help us connect people to affordable housing.
As head of the Department of Government Efficiency, Musk is tasked with slashing federal funding. He has said he could trim $1 trillion from the federal deficit by addressing waste, fraud, and abuse. With Musk's access to the U.S. Treasury payment system, leaders at LSS are left with questions about the future.
Would you be able to function if you lost federal funding?
We would continue to do what we can to advance our mission to care for people in need, but our capacity to be able to do that would be severely impacted if we did not have these grants.
For now, Lutheran Social Services of Central Ohio will continue to operate as normal. Reporting in Columbus, Carla Rogner, 10 TV News.
Carla, thank you. Meanwhile, a lot of the actions taken so far by the Trump administration appear to be out of Project 2025. It is something President Trump has denied having any connection to while he was campaigning. But Democrats still sounded the alarm, warning that a second Trump term would bring changes from the immigration crackdown to dismantling DEI. Reporter Tom Foreman examines how those warnings are playing out today.
Reforming or doing away with the Federal Disaster Relief Agency, FEMA, dismantling diversity programs, rolling back environmental restrictions, accepting only two genders, replacing nonpartisan federal workers with administration loyalists, and aggressively pursuing undocumented immigrants. All of those ideas are being pushed by President Donald Trump.
We're getting rid of all of the cancer. I call it cancer. The cancer caused by the Biden administration.
And a CNN analysis has found many of Trump's plans reflect deep ties to Project 2025, the 900-page plan of action put out by the Conservative Heritage Foundation.
Look, I think the data speaks for itself. There is a clear overlap between what Donald Trump is doing so far and what Project 2025 has proposed.
During the campaign, Trump repeatedly denied any links to the project.
I have nothing to do with Project 2025. That's out there. I haven't read it. I don't want to read it purposely. I'm not going to read it.
And yet, of the 53 executive actions in his first week in office, CNN's analysis found more than two-thirds align with the project's proposals. At least 140 Trump administration officials and dozens of allies helped craft that document, including his new CIA director, chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, and Tom Homan, the border czar.
We're going to go where we got to go, whether it's a school, a church, or a hospital.
More specifics. When the South American country of Colombia initially refused to accept military planes loaded with deportees, Trump quickly and aggressively threatened to impose a punishing tariff, right on script with what Project 2025 proposed.
As you know, in Colombia, they agreed with us almost immediately after I got involved.
Trump immediately revoked the security clearance of top government officials suspected of not supporting his goals. And he's talked up more oil drilling in the far north, where the Project 2025 plan says Alaska is a special case and deserves immediate action. For all that, a Trump spokesman still insists the new president had nothing to do with Project 2025. And he's just securing the border, restoring common sense, driving down inflation, and unleashing American energy.
That was Tom Foreman reporting.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
Providing extra support to Ohio children while they're in school. That's what Ohio Governor Mike DeWine says he wants to do with his newly proposed state budget. Inside that proposal, he is pushing for lawmakers to back a program for students to get the eye care they need and driver's education classes. The budget also guarantees admission to any Ohio college or university for students in the top 5% of their class. It also provides a $5,000 yearly scholarship. Now, the governor is also proposing a new child tax credit to help families with rising costs. But some families say the size of that credit is not nearly enough. 10TV's Bryn Caswell spoke to parents about if this proposal will actually make a difference.
Half of Ohio parents have said they've had to cut back on their work hours in order to offset high child care costs. Some tell me this proposed child care tax may help, but some are worried it's just not enough.
Governor Mike DeWine has asked lawmakers to approve a yearly child tax credit in his latest budget proposal. It would give families up to $1,000 a year with children six and below.
This will be paid by an increase in the cigarette tax of $1.50.
Mom of two, Haley Rogers, feels it won't help. She left her career to offset high child care costs.
$1,000 isn't really enough to have me go right back working in my career that I love. $1,000 a month? Okay, now we're talking. But, you know, $1,000 a year, that doesn't even cover 2 weeks of childcare.
Daycare owner and mom, Christy Thompson, is upset her youngest child won't qualify for the tax credit. Her youngest is eight.
It would help me put food on the table and pay my bills. I mean, that's exactly where all that money goes.
According to budget documents, the child tax credit would be refundable, and some portion would be available to parents with a joint income of $94,000 or less. Rogers thinks middle-class families will continue to be forgotten.
Just because we're above that line doesn't mean we don't need help. Between rent prices, student loans, everyday living expenses, add on top of it, you know, childcare, there is no help for us. We don't qualify for anything.
And that was Bryn Caswell reporting. Meanwhile, you just heard Governor DeWine say that he does plan to pay for this with a proposed cigarette tax increase. So here's what that would mean. The tax on a pack of 20 cigarettes will nearly double from $1.60 to $3.10 a pack. Most other tobacco products would be taxed at 42% of the wholesale price, which is up from the current 17%. The governor says this move will help prevent nearly 12,000 kids from becoming smokers. And right now, Ohio has the 29th highest cigarette tax rate in the country. DeWine also proposing to raise taxes on sports betting to help pay for new stadiums. And he says he wants to double the sports gaming tax from 20% to 40%. DeWine says this would bring in an additional $130 to $180 million a year. That money will go into a fund for professional sports facilities and also youth sports education.
In honor of all those we've lost to cancer and those still fighting and thriving, like basketball analyst and cancer champion Dick Vitale.
I want to beat cancer. I'm going to beat it. That's no doubt in my mind. I'm going to win this battle.
Defeating cancer will take all of us. Join our team to help fund game-changing research that saves lives. At the V Foundation, V is for victory over cancer. V is for victory over the odds. V is for victory over health disparities. Victory over setbacks. Victory over the unknown. V is for victory over giving up.
Don't give up. Don't ever give up.
Donate to the V Foundation to join our team and help save lives.
Cancer can take away all my physical abilities. It cannot touch my mind. It cannot touch my heart. And it cannot touch my soul.
100% of donations fund game-changing cancer research. Donate now to the V Foundation at V.org.
In just 16 days, Ohio's controversial bathroom law is going into effect. This new law requires students at all schools and colleges to use a bathroom that aligns with the gender they were assigned at birth. However, this law does not include an enforcement mechanism, and that's something that the state's largest public school district is considering to take advantage of. 10TV's Colin Dorsey was at last week's Columbus School Board meeting, as that district is now debating whether or not to comply with the new law.
I sit here as a member of this board who has given so much to this community and our kids to fight.
A challenging decision on what to do for some board members about this policy, which, as it's written right now, goes against the state's so-called bathroom bill. That law requires students to use bathrooms based on their biological sex at birth. The board had been considering two options: rewriting the policy in accordance with state law or scrap it altogether. Then tonight, a third option.
I'd like to keep it the way it is.
Doing that would be against the law, and district legal counsel says could open the school up to a legal fight. It's something I pressed board president Michael Cole about after tonight's meeting.
A lot of discussion tonight. Does that mean the board could possibly be willing to stand in the face of state law?
Well, at this point, that opportunity was tabled.
If we're not going to stand up and do what's right, I'm not really sure what we're here for.
Parent Carrie Kinzerski is in favor of keeping the policy as is or getting it off the books to support students it affects.
The amount of injustice that trans people have to experience already and that they're going to have to experience with the other laws once they go into effect is tragic.
The current CCS policy allows transgender students to use a bathroom corresponding with their gender identity. Last year, the conservative group Parents Defending Education took issue with the district's policy, calling it vague in regards to parental rights with students identifying as transgender. With the discussion tabled, the clock is ticking, and the question still stands of what is the board going to do?
One lawsuit can be millions and millions and millions of dollars in a district where millions of dollars are whether or not you can feed children and keep the heat on.
And that was Colin Dorsey reporting. Now, Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost says he is ready to take legal action against Columbus City Schools if they do not comply with the law. And meantime, the board indicated that it could call a special session to talk about this matter further before voting at the next meeting, which is just 1 week before that bathroom bill would take effect.
Again, that's Angela Ann, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.